Tonight on Arena, Lauri Moore on her new novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home, and Asteroid City, No Hard Feelings, and The Last Rider are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Tonight, Picture Perfect Desert Classic from Wes Anderson. J-Law is back with a body comedy and a tale of triumph over adversity in the greatest race, road race of them all. Welcome to Arena's film reviews on this Thursday evening. Jennifer Lawrence, it is, who is back starring in No Hard Feelings, a comedy about a cash-strapped 30-something woman who takes a dubious job to get a car. In The Last Rider, we see the remarkable story of US cyclist Greg LeMond and his daring escapades on the roads, cobbles and mountains of France in the 1980s, and Asteroid City, where Wes Anderson locates himself in the sun-drenched dunes with a very starry cast of characters all doing Wes Anderson's thing. There's even a roadrunner. Tara Brady and Paul Whittington have been to the movies for us and are with me in studio this evening. And let's start with the man we spoke to on Arena last night, Mr. Wes Anderson. Asteroid City, what a cast he has here. I think last night when I was introducing the interview, I named about 8 of the cast. Mm. And there was another 8, if not more, that I could have named afterwards. But maybe before we get into the starry cast, can you give us a succinct version of the setup, well, Paul? Did I say that it was Tara Brady and Paul Whittington? I think I did.
Sean, I mean, his films are always tricksy in terms of their setup. They play with story and storytelling and so on. This particularly does. So Asteroid City is this place in the middle of the desert. It's September 1955. And these various characters come into town for this science convention for kids. But it's not real. Asteroid City is, in fact, a play written by this playwright called Conrad Erpert, played by Edward Norton, quite amusingly. And Bryan Cranston, a sort of radio or TV introducer from the 50s, he introduces us to the play first, the idea, and then we're taken into the world itself, and we're taken into it on board a train in a reference to a great film called Bad Day at Black Rock, also from 1955. So there's all sorts of references going on.
Yeah, and I suppose people, I think a Wes Anderson is probably a more Easter egg-filled film than most any Wes Anderson film. But that 1955 aspect of things, it's quite a specific year, and there are lots of things going on, not least of which, Tara, is paranoia.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of that going on, and there's this sort of the kind of golden age of technology and the golden age of science fiction, and you end up with these yet another layer are all these science fiction gadgets that you get, and then you're cutting across to other aspects of the 50s, like the Actors Studio in New York, which is another very specific thing, and we do at the very beginning, like, there are glimpses of there's the idea that there's atomic material on the train, so you're getting a lot of the Cold War, but on this very kind of down low way, because of course it's a Wes Anderson film, so everything's on the down low and everything's delivered in that very kind of deadpan way. The Cold War has never been so deadpan.
Yeah, but there's something extraordinary that I'll come to about the deadpanness of it all in a moment. But these are huge actors, Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, who haven't been in there before, lots of others who have been in Wes Anderson films before. They do. In inverted commas.
They fit right in.
Absolutely nothing. Look as if they're absolutely doing nothing on screen.
Well, in a way, I quite agree
with
that.
That's the cleverness of it, I suppose.
But it's like hipster blank verse or something, and they all have to do it. And Tom Hanks actually does it quite well. He's Jason Schwartzman's character, his father-in-law, and he dresses like a kind of golf pro from the 1950s, and he's very disapproving. Scarlett Johansson and Schwartzman are the two. If there are main characters, they're the two. She's a Hollywood star. He is this kind of magnum type, a war photographer. And he's just become widowed and is still working up the courage to tell his children. And he and the movie star, I think Scarlett Johansson is actually really, I think she finds the space to do something in this. And they're relationship is at the middle of it, if there is a middle of it, which there isn't really.
Yeah, but what I say doing nothing, if when you're watching the screen, you're kind of amazed at how little expression there seems to be, certainly on their faces and in their voices. But let us listen to a clip which I think is a very different experience than watching the film. This is one that contains several of the cast. In fact, Stephen Park is in here, Hope Davis is in here, Liev Schreiber is in here, Steve Carell. And the junior stargazers, there are these young, successful students who've been brought to Asteroid City. Their parents are just as competitive as the children are. So they're all having a kind of a child off here, where they're trying to work out whose child is the biggest genius. Steve Carell is the truth bombing hotel manager in the midst of all of this.
I strongly question whether your daughter's silly putty resembles anything from outer space.
It's not silly putty. It's called S'mores Tosium.
This is excellent.
Thank you. It's really all the machine's doing.
What the devil do you know about astrogeology anyway, JJ, whatever that stands for?
I just maintain the workings.
Kelly's thesis is supported by...
flimsy, outdated evidence.
I beg your pardon.
Not in my opinion. I like the silly putty or S'mores Tosium. In fact, I'm just quoting what he said.
Your son's project might very well have killed us all today, by the way.
Coming from the family that brought us the electromagnetic death ray.
It's a weapon. Of course it's lethal.
So you admit it.
Not to mention Brainiac's flag. I mean, is he trying to provoke World War III or something?
The jet propulsion belt is eminently safe. I'd allow an 8-year-old boy to operate it. In fact, I did. Ricky's cousin Chip, and he broke the solo flight altitude record.
They're strange, aren't they? They're children, compared to normal people.
Yes.
That's correct.
It's true.
Steve Carell, they're saying they're strange, aren't they, your children, compared to normal people. I was saying, Tara, as we were listening to that, what struck me about the clips when I listened to them without the visuals is just how much expression there is in the voice, which that's a very disciplined type of acting.
Yeah, no, it definitely is, because I think when you're watching it, more than any of the other previous Anderson films, it feels far more like one of his animations. And it feels like he's gotten actors to do this kind of diorama thing. And particularly when you get to the parts where Scarlett Johansson's character is sort of emulating Marilyn Monroe, it's so stylized. And one of the things I think is really interesting about it is that the people who love it are very often saying exactly the same things about it as the people who hate it. Yeah. That it's Anderson distilled. Yeah. That it's completely style over substance. That it's kind of that this is kind of the essence of what he does. That, you know, that it's all kind of visual driven and there's nothing really going on.
Are you on one or other of those extremes?
I'm kind of in the middle, because I think it's a really beautiful thing, but I don't think all the layers work. For example, I think like the kind of where it gets very kind of intertextual and metatextual, like, and it gets a little bit tangled up. If you have a character as Jason Schwartzman and Scarlett Johansson, if you have two people who are playing actors who are playing different characters, they need to be a bit different from one another, and I don't think that they are. I think there's little moments where it sort of springs to life. I love the little bits with Tom Hanks and the three grandchildren. And then you learn afterwards that they were never in the same room. No, the children were never in the same room, and they were there because the way he made it, like he made them all separately and shot things separately and put layers on top of each other.
Like you would
a cartoon. But it just feels like there's a little bit of life about it in a way that I don't think there always is. And I don't feel like there's as much emotional heft as there is you would have gotten something like Grand Budapest Hotel, or certainly not in his early films Royal Tenenbaums.
The last sort of great Wes Anderson film was Grand Budapest Hotel, which is really, you can watch it again and again, it's a beautiful thing. French Dispatch annoyed me very deeply, and I thought Isle of Dogs, I kind of liked it. I can't remember a thing about it now. But the visuals
here,
oh beautiful!
You can't but be impressed by them.
I think I liked this film a bit more than Tara did, because it was a bit less glib than his films sometimes can be, and also I thought at the start this is going to annoy me, and then for some reason it didn't. It is absolutely beautifully made. The way he makes things is so particular, so much detail, so many layers, so much that doesn't need to be there, and that in my opinion adds to it is in there. But I also think that in a strange way he's kind of asking you, you know, like anytime we watch a film, we know it's a film, but we suspend our disbelief because we need stories. He's sort of adding two layers to that here. And in a way, he's saying, can you still care about it? Now, obviously, perhaps Sarah couldn't, but in a way, I did. Because the two central, the Schwartzman and Johansson characters, there's a sort of air of desperation about them, so I became sort of interested in
it. Yeah, there is a kind of a love story that somehow has almost got a narrative.
It doesn't look like it's going to end.
Yeah. Stars overall from you, Paul?
For me, 4.
A solid 4 from you. I don't think you're quite there, Tara.
No, I'm 3. I'm definitely split
and
down the middle.
And generously at that, you would say, Tara, would you?
Yeah. Well, they're not going to be putting your annoyed me less than French Dispatch on the poster either.
No, that's true. That's a good point.
All right. A difference of opinion. 4 and 3, respectively, there for Asteroid City. And let us move on then to The Last Rider. As this year's Tour de France approaches at the start of next month, The Last Rider is a feature documentary which tells the remarkable story of US rider Greg LeMond. Cycling fans will know that he was the first American to really challenge the European riders who dominated the sports into the 1980s and 90s. Unbelievable personal story at the heart of this, as well as his sporting prowess, and both are interweaved here. Just remind us of Greg LeMond. I suppose Sean Kelly would have known him very well. That's the era we're in here, really, isn't it, Tara?
This is 1989, and I believe Sean Kelly finished 9th that year in the Tour de France. You have to feel sorry for like some of the great Tour de France events since, because it's the one I was, well, this was great, but it's no 1989. It has that sort of aura around it, because you had this huge battle between LeMond and Fignon, and LeMond is this like incredibly affable American, I remember sort of like there was this sort of idea that it's like, oh, this American coming over here, and he won over the French, which is really like saying something,
because
he was such a cheery kind of fellow, and he had such a nice. Whereas Fignon was definitely not that. Was always kind of a hard, was kind of a bad boy. Was always hard to like, took everything really seriously. So you have this kind of like brilliantly clashing sort of personalities as well. And there's nothing flashy technically in this documentary, but it's talking heads, and it's good people telling their story.
Yeah.
And it's a good story because there's, you get all of his backstory leading up to these like two huge traumatic events.
Yeah, I suppose that is what we get here. The two distinct phases in his in his career. Just give us a sense of. It really was within his personal life that lots of things went awry, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, because I wasn't aware of all of that watching it, I did remember the 89 race and so on, which is maybe kind of like a Hunt Loud, I think, for cyclists.
Yeah.
But he was the first American to, I think, to join a tour team, never mind win the tour. And then he's doing well, and there's lots of treachery within his own team, which is classic Tour de France. And then he wins in 86, and then we find out that it's so important to him that the tour is clean and pure. And the reason is because cycling saved him. He was a victim of child abuse, and then cycling helped him recover. So it's really important to him that cycling is pure.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip. He's talking here about his first Tour de France win. And kind of bittersweet.
Six,
he wasn't really supported by the other riders, which is what you're talking about, that kind of division among the team.
No.
So that brings back painful memories of the abuse he suffered as a child. And we'll also hear Greg LeMond's wife in here, Kathy LeMond.
He was grooming me at a very young age. He did what he did regularly. He'd come down for work and spend the night one night and then go back up to Tahoe. That lasts probably a year and 3 months. I didn't know how to tell my parents, how do you tell them? Somehow you think you're responsible for it, or somehow you willingly participate in this thing, so that's part of the shame.
Bob and Bertha, they had no idea that Greg had been molested. And when Greg started cycling with his dad, this guy was no longer in Greg's life. And it was kind of this redemption. When you're a boy and you're molested by a man, you feel really a lot of shame. And the cycling was his path to feeling good about himself.
Got so busy, got so into cycling, but it was always there. That was always there. And sometime, one day down the road, no matter where you are, it comes back to hit you.
When the deep pain of the betrayal from Hino, when that cracked open, it was the first time as an adult that Greg had allowed himself to go back to the molestation.
It's been a very bittersweet victory. I wish I could be... I think when I get to Champs-Élysées and it's over, I'll be happy, but it's... I mean, it's hard to be happy right now. There's so much pressure, so much tension in the air. It's been difficult.
That's a clip there from No Hard Feelings, from Le Monde, the cycling documentary that we're speaking about. And we mentioned, I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear the man and his wife describe that child abuse that he suffered. Then, so he wins 1986, and there's the bittersweet aspect there, but it's kind of some kind of redemption within it. Then a year later,
yeah, it's an extraordinary story. He's out. It's like Thanksgiving, and you know, it's America, and they're out with the family, and he ends up accidentally getting shot by his brother-in-law.
And it is an accidental shooting.
An extraordinary amount of blood. Like there were 45 pellets in his body that had to be removed. I mean, it was like he was absolutely like his body was devastated. So he has to build himself up out of that. But one of the things that's really interesting and listening to him and the wife and like they come across as really lovely people. But like the fact that the wins, there was so much riding on the win, you know, not just because it's like this great comeback story, but because there's so much guilt in the family around this event. Yeah, like, you can imagine, like, because, you know, the family were all, you know, sort of, you know, they were all in some way connected with him and, you know, maybe his business, and they were all
supportive, when he won in 89, it healed the family because the brother-in-law hadn't ruined his life, basically.
Yeah, I suppose that is the lovely aspect of it. And it essentially sounds like a good story well told by nice people, that sounds a bit dull.
No, it's not dull at all. And as Tara said, there's nothing particularly interesting about it cinematically, but it's just the story's well told. And you get a sense also of what extraordinary athletes cyclists are. And at the end, it says very pointedly that Greg LeMond is the only American who's ever won the Tour de France.
Yes, because, of course, there's a big blank chunk on Tour de France history, which is one of the really nice things about this documentary is that it's an antidote to that and it to the kind of disgraces.
And he feels like an antidote to that because he's so honest about everything.
Yeah, so, okay. So, stars from you on this one, Tara.
4.
Solid 4.
Same for me.
Yeah. Oh, agreement.
Yeah. Yes.
The family are talking again. Right, let's just move on to film number 3. What's going to happen here? No Hard Feelings.
Finally,
No Hard Feelings. I can't believe that I am going to tell you how this film is built. It's built as, and I quote, a raunchy comedy. Mm-hmm. Unquote, starring Jennifer Lawrence. Is some viewing this as a big comeback for the Oscar winner. She plays a character called Maddie who comes to an unusual arrangement with the parents of a highly strung and far younger student. Oh, I'm looking over at you, Tara, and I see I'm ready to go. That's what's written on your face. Tell me.
Oh, well, first of all, one of the things we were talking about outside was if you're doing a sex comedy, you know, it doesn't matter what era, like American Pie, Porky's, all that sort of thing, and because this is more or less the same territory as, like, if you remember Sylvia Christel in Private Lessons, it's the older woman and the younger man.
Yeah.
But the whole point of a sex comedy is that you're supposed to be doing something naughty. Like, you're supposed to be going, oh, this is inappropriate, but I'm going to do it anyway. So in this film, like, straight off the bat, it's like going, you have this cozy conversation with Jennifer Lawrence and the boy's parents, Matthew Broderick is the father, and they're there going, of course, we all are very supportive of sex work. So that's a bit like starting off American Pie and having the parents at the start of the movie come in and say, well, of course, we're very, very supportive of dessert-related sexual activities. So straight off the bat, it doesn't understand the genre that it's in. But all of the jokes are horrible. I not only didn't laugh once, but it's like a kind of a cringe comedy, but with only cringe and no comedy. Yeah. She's doing this kind of Mrs. Robinson stuff at first, and none of it works. The script just falls from under her every time. It's a very, very poor script, and it's one of those comedies that's really airless. Like, it just, it feels like there's dead air around every single line.
As you suggest, it has no confidence in itself, I don't think. And also,
we've heard the Jennifer Lawrence character. Just explain the basic setup of why she's in the situation she is and who this young guy is.
She lives in Montauk, New York, a seaside town, sort of near the Hamptons. And she's a local, and there's all these rich newbies have moved in, and all the locals hate the newbies. All the surfer locals hate the newbies. She's living in her mother's house and hasn't moved on. Her mother died, and she's an Uber driver. And then her car gets repossessed because she hasn't paid her taxes, and her house may be repossessed as well. So she's desperate for money. So she sees this ad on Craigslist. Now, it doesn't matter if the premise in a comedy, or if you could even call this romantic comedy, is silly. You buy into it if it works.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work at all. It's extremely uncomfortable viewing. And also, I don't know if there's a kind of charmlessness to it that extends to her. I don't know if she can do comedy, but on this evidence, perhaps not.
Okay, let's have a listen to a clip. This is Jennifer Lawrence's Maddie, and she's meeting prospective employers here, Matthew Broderick and Laura Benatti. They're Percy's parents. This is the young fellow with whom the Mrs. Robinson style.
Seems perfectly all right to me. I don't know what I'm so worried about.
Right, let's have a listen to the clip.
I meant to ask this on the phone, but how old are you?
Well, I know you were looking for someone early to mid-20s. I'm slightly older.
Right. How old?
I just turned 29.
Recently?
Last year.
So you're 29?
Last year.
And how old are you, like, right now?
One more year older.
So 30?
Yeah. 32.
There you go. That's Jennifer Lawrence, Laura Benatti, and Matthew Broderick in a scene from No Hard Feelings. I would have thought Jennifer Lawrence could be a good comedian if she had the right material.
Well, she certainly, there's comic touches and stuff like Silver Linings Playbook, there's saying, but this is kind of naked pratfalls. And in fact, there's this kind of weird scene where she has like this kind of big fist fight with like three teenagers on a beach when she's naked, and that is as unfunny as it sounds.
And also, why was it necessary to do that? Why did whoever wanted to do that?
But it's like everything else in the thing, Paul. It just feels like it just wants to be edgy all the time, and it just feels like it's throwing in like nudity just for the sake of it. It feels like it's doing this just for the sake of it. And at the same time, and again, it comes back to it. It has no confidence in itself, because this is the only sex comedy I've ever seen that doesn't actually have a single sex act in it.
No, it doesn't. No raunchiness either.
Jennifer Lawrence is a really fine actor.
Mm. Oh, absolutely.
She's a fine dramatic actor.
Dramatic actor. But a different thing.
Yeah, but why
has it gone so wrong?
I think every film, every good film starts with a good screenplay. Every bad film starts with a bad screenplay. And this is a bad screenplay. And it was a stupid idea, and if they just didn't make it work. And even if they'd cast somebody else, like a young Sandra Bullock, who's the best screen comedian of her time, she couldn't have made it work either.
Well, I remember thinking if they had somebody who's really good at cringe, like Aubrey Plaza, it might have been a tiny bit better. Yeah. It still would have been a dreadful film. Yeah. There's just not enough there to work with.
No.
All right. I think it's fairly clear that neither of you got on well with this. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, is it down to that screenplay aspect that Paul is talking about there, Tara?
Yeah. No. I mean, there's just a mess of ideas here. There's it goes on about gentrification. It goes on about none of them sticks together. And then there's like look at these millennials and looking at the Gen Z kids, and the Gen Z kids are crazy.
They have a pop
and
it's them
like
as well, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, who's this film for?
Right, so stars.
I'm going to a generous one, Sean.
A generous one. This Thursday evening. And Paul?
Half stars, 1.5 for me, Sean.
1.5? You like the owl half, you don't like...
I love a half, yeah.
Okay. A generous 1.5, I think that possibly is as well. That's Paul Whittington and Tara Brady, and our three films this evening, Asteroid City and No Hard Feelings, both on general release, and The Last Rider, the documentary cycling film that we were talking about, is unlimited release. Finally getting to say it. We'll be back with Laurie Moore after this break. I Am Homeless, If This Is Not My Home is the new novel from writer Laurie Moore. It's set in the recent past, 2016, and post-American Civil War period. We first meet Elizabeth, an innkeeper in the mid-1860s. She's writing to her sister, describing her amorous wounded lodger, who sports a lush moustache and is a gift for quoting Shakespeare. Skip on to 2016. We're in a hospice where Finn is visiting his dying brother Max, but is called away with distressing news about an ex-girlfriend called Lily. What follows is a macabre road trip that asks questions of us about death and dying and much else besides, I'm sure, as Laurie Moore, who joins us this evening, I'm sure will explain to me. I'm delighted to have you with us on this Thursday evening here in Ireland, and I presume afternoon with you, Laurie. We open with your innkeeper, Elizabeth, in post-Civil War America, writing to her dead sister. In fact, and these letters punctuate the book. Just give us a little bit of her particular situation and this lodger that she's very suspicious of.
The innkeeper is keeping a diary of letters to her dead sister, and she's communicating about all the lodgers, but there is some particular mysterious guest. I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
But the book really is about things and people and concepts and parts of the country that you assume have vanished or gone, but somehow return and are resurrected. So it plays fast and loose with the idea of death.
Well, I suppose that you touch on this idea that things that we presume that are vanished and that are gone, that aspect, that part of the book is just post-Civil War America. The other part of the book, the story about Finn and his brother Max, who is dying and is in a hospice, that is in 2016. Were those two eras speaking to each other in some very particular way when you were writing?
They are, but it's subtle, and it's a kind of vibrating communication, because again, it's about ostensibly dead people coming back, and it's also about the Confederacy coming back. It's about which is what happened with the election of Trump. But I don't want to make too flat-footed a connection between the two. They are supposed to be in subtle conversation with each other, but I realize they seem to be very far away. But as you read through the book, I think you can see the little connections and then the larger ones too by the time you get to the end. Finn himself has possession of this notebook, of this journal. So the letters are sort of spilling out of his narrative. The narrative of 1871 is spilling out of the narrative of 2016. And he, in fact, with Lily, stays in the boarding house that the innkeeper originally
wrote the letters in. Yeah,
but so it's a little steal from Tom Stoppard's Arcadia.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, the bit that we haven't really got into fully, let us just explain that Max, I think I've said this, but just for clarity, Finn, his brother Max, is dying and is in very close to death, in fact, as the action of the novel starts. But Finn does get called off to Lily, who is dead, fully and absolutely, well, I'm saying fully and absolutely dead, because that is what I thought until I started reading your book and reading about this character. How do you explain her current state in the novel, Laurie?
Well, she herself says that she's death adjacent, that death is a spectrum. And for the griever, for anyone who has lost someone, death does feel like a spectrum because disbelief conjures the person, and and everybody knows how it is to lose someone and have that deceased person appear to them in various ways, in dreams, suddenly see them across the street. And so I thought, well, what if you actually saw them, you know, in the cemetery? And what kind of narrative would ensue for someone who has lost someone they love, and who has a habit of not believing the official narratives anyway?
Yeah, so that side of so fake narratives is what we're talking about in some ways, is it?
Right. So Finn is embarking on his own unofficial narrative, because he's always trying to peek around the corners of the official ones.
Yeah, I have to come to this character of Lily. She is decomposing in front of us on the page as we read. Now, I would associate a lot of your writing with it. Naturalism isn't quite, but you know, where it's in a very real world with very real people often dealing with very real problems. This kind of goes off into a place that I really didn't expect it to go. What were the challenges of writing a character who was decomposing in front of you and kind of had to for the narrative to move along, has to decompose?
Well, someone asked me what research I did for it, and I didn't do any research. I just invented her body as it's disintegrating, and it kind of comes and goes. You know, the body sometimes looks better or worse than other times, but it really is all intended to be an expression of Finn's love for her, no matter what. And his grief for her, no matter what. And so it is about bereavement and the continuation of connection on into death from the realm of life.
And you know, as we're describing it, I'm aware that people are saying, but Lonnie Moore is a very funny writer. I mean, I'm always laughing with her one-line quips and the things that her characters can say. They were laughing in this book as well. Were you surprised by the humor that came out of that particular situation? Or, you know.
Oh, I'm never surprised by humor, because it's just everywhere in the world. And so even if you're in the most gruesome circumstances, there's something funny going on, or there's something you can see that is, you know, amusing, or someone will say something amusing or witty. It's a form of generosity. It's a form of denial. It's a form of tension release. My sense of the world is that if you're not including what is funny, you're not seeing it whole. And so what I always intend in any story or novel is for the entirety of the world of the characters to be registered on the page.
And did you know from the outset, Laurie, as you were writing this, you know, that you were definitely in the world of a novel? Was that on your mind from the starting point?
That
it was a novel as opposed to something that might end as a short story? I mean, do you go into it openly like that, or do you know when you start where you're heading?
Oh, I every novel I've started as a novel. It's never been a story that somehow grew and became a novel. No, I always think, in fact, I always think I have a novel that's 1,000 pages long. And, you know, then I get to page 200 and it's done. But or sometimes even less. But I intended this as a novel, and this is what it turned out to be, of course.
And is that because the ideas that are there, I mean, to discuss death is obviously a huge topic and something that we will all experience at some point along the way, you know, so it's a universal theme. But it struck me that perhaps it's not quite just death that you're talking, you wanted to explore here. It is that kind of crossover point. There's a character in the hospice with Max, his Ghanaian aide, William it is, who talks about, we see death as part of life. It's not necessarily something we do in the West, to use that phrase.
Right. And in fact, Finn feels quite sorry for this young man, because he feels someone has just sort of brainwashed him into this idea so that he can keep this job and feel comfortable with this job. But in fact, then Finn embarks on his own sort of, you know, death being part of life and life being part of death, adventure. So, yeah. The other thing that also makes a novel is dealing with time and dealing with two structural components. So it's a bicameral narrative, and that's very difficult to do in short story writing unless you're Alice Munro. She can do anything. But for the rest of us, you really need a novel to have two different narrative strands that are interwoven or having a subtle conversation with each other.
It struck me too, and I don't know if this, you were writing this, I think, in 2016. It was in that year. You subsequently lost both your parents, am I right in thinking? Your father died during the period of the pandemic, is that correct?
Right. I lost a lot of people. There are a lot of, I mean, I'm just at that age. I'm sure you're not anywhere near that age, but at a certain age, you really just start to lose people. And it starts to seem unacceptable. And it starts to seem like everyone you love best is on the other side. And so that was on my mind. Mm. It's a slightly childish and stubborn response to death, because it's a very difficult thing to accept that a particular person has just vanished.
And what stage was the novel at when your father died during that period? Was it nearing completion? Was it almost there?
I thought it was. Let's see. That's 2020. It was probably about three quarters done. But then I stopped the novel, and I ended up writing a story about my father's death. Whenever you write a novel and you're also a short story writer, you sometimes have to put the novel on hold to write particular stories that come with their urgent subjects and need to be responded to. And that's what happened. So I did write a story based on my father's death. I'm sorry for that. Those traffic sounds are coming in.
No, don't worry. We're not hearing them. It's just outside your window. we're not getting them here. But I wonder to what extent to accepting your point about writing that story that directly addressed, I suppose, in some ways, your father's death. Having completed the novel and now having that little bit of space, and it's a short period, the loss of a parent at any age is never easy. And I think your mother died subsequent to that as well, didn't she? And you've mentioned that you lost a lot. You've been losing a lot of people in recent years. Did the completion of the novel, and now with hindsight, has it made your own personal thoughts around those losses? Has it changed those thoughts in any way?
Probably not, but it was interesting to travel with Finn and see how stubborn he was about not releasing someone he loved to death. You know, keeping company with someone and refusing to let death take this person, and believing that she had certain powers also to overcome it. Because, you know, he just felt she had resisted death before. Even though she has a history of being suicidal, she had always, you know, triumphed over it before. And he somehow suspects she can triumph over it again. So traveling with him, with his journey, was interesting to me because the rest of us in real life, of course, have to, you know, accept death, and we can't, you know, say it didn't happen.
He's in a fiction and he can do that. I suppose it is the ultimate act of love, isn't it? The letting go. I suppose that's ultimately where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, both letting go and hanging on. There's a kind of combination of both those stories.
Laurie, thanks so much for speaking to us this evening. That's Laurie Moore. That's Laurie Moore speaking to us about her new novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home.
Claudia Boyle is one of our most successful international sopranos. She made her debut, in fact, at the Paris Opera last year, returning there next year. Right now, she's in Cardiff, rehearsing with the Welsh National Opera and their production of Leonard Bernstein's Candide, a role she first took on in Rome a decade ago. And of course, earlier this year, she starred alongside Celine Byrne and Paula Murray in the Irish National Opera large-scale production of Der Rosenkavalier. Claudia will be back home, back in Ireland, at the end of this month for a concert she has curated herself, performing her favourite contemporary tunes as well as arias from the world of opera. That's happening at St. Bridget's Cathedral in Kildare as part of the 45th Kildare Derby Festival. Claudia's joining me on the line from Cardiff. I think literally you hot-footed off the stage to speak to me this evening, Claudia.
I did, Sean. I'm literally just about 5 minutes off the stage. We're in the final stages of rehearsal, pending our performance, our opening night for Candide. And it's really fantastic and exciting stage of rehearsals because, you know, you've been in a rehearsal room for so many weeks in a studio, and then suddenly you get to be in costumes, you get to be on the stage, you get to be in the set and really immerse yourself in it. So it's a very exciting stage. It's an intense stage, but it's really, really exciting. So all singers and artists love this stage.
Yeah, and I guess the other side of that is that the orchestra in with you at this stage, or are you still dealing with costumes and the technical side of things like that?
They are. Now, this actual rehearsal today was with piano. Sometimes when you're doing, you know, you're focusing on just the very technical issues of it. And that's always done first with piano. You get maybe 3 or 4 sessions with piano and then the orchestra come in. Now, we did have a Zitprobe earlier on during the week. And so that was very exciting. And that's the first time you get to literally, and as the name suggests, a Zitprobe, it's a sitting rehearsal. So you just get to focus on the music for that.
I love that term.
That's also...
I love that term, Zitprobe.
It's great, isn't it? It's all these little terms that you know you get to know and love, and you know they're just stages of the rehearsal process in getting an opera onto its feet, and so it's great. I'm really enjoying it. It's going to be a fantastic production. But I love Bernstein. I just love it. I think there's nothing like it. He's just a genius. There's so much energy and humor and joy and rhythm in his music. It's pure. It's a privilege to sing.
Obviously it's based on the Voltaire novel, the Candide opera. What's the character you play within that?
It's Cunegonde.
And she is the love interest?
She's Candide's love interest, yeah. So it's great. You know, I mean, listen, it's satire. It's great to play with all that, and it's very, very clever. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about what you're going to be singing at this upcoming concert in Kildare. I'm just going to fly straight.
Yeah.
I'm going to fly straight into one of the pieces. People will know this piece, but they won't expect it. Well, they kind of know it was done for voice as well, I'm sure. But you normally hear this in an oboe, but you know, you're going to sing it. Let's hear a version of Nella Fantasia that you did earlier with the National Symphony Orchestra. Little flavour there of Claudia Boyle and the National Symphony Orchestra with Nella Fantasia, of course, the vocal version, I suppose, of Gabriel's oboe. It was Sarah Brightman, I think, who she strong-armed Ennio Morricone into giving her that as a vocal piece. Did he write the lyrics, or who wrote the lyrics for it, or do you know, Claudia?
Do you know, I'm not actually sure where the lyrics are sourced from, but sopranos don't like hearing the word no, Sean. And I normally, you know, I wouldn't be a huge, you know, fan of you know, messing with something, and it's certainly a score and a melody that was so beautiful. But I have to say, she was right on this one. I think it works so well for the voice. I love singing it. It sits very well in the voice. It's such a beautiful melody, and actually the lyrics are equally beautiful. Mm. Nella Fantasia, io vedo un mondo giusto. Like in my fantasy, I see a world that's just, where people can live in peace and honesty. And that melody is so pure and beautiful. And I think the lyrics reflect that, and vice versa. So she was right. Now she wrote to him. I think she asked him over 10 times, and he was very protective of his music for good reason.
Yeah.
And he said no, and then she just wore him down, and he eventually said, "Oh, go on then."
The oboe and the soprano voice, because it's a tune that Morricone wrote for oboe. They do complement each other. When you think of many of the great arias in opera, you'll often have an oboe maybe counterpointing the melody. It would often be one of those woodwind instruments that would be doing that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just what springs to mind as well is that beautiful cadenza in Lucia for the flute and the voice.
Lucia de Lammermoor.
Donizetti. And because, you know, they're using their breath and they're such song-like instruments, you know. So if it does work for oboe, a wind instrument, of course it's going to work for voice as well. And this particular melody certainly does, yeah.
What about transferring the voice of Bruce Springsteen onto the voice of Claudia Boyle?
It's funny, I love when concerts reflect me, and certainly the older I'm getting, that's important to me, Sean. It really is.
Yeah.
It's important to me to sing different types of music. And I think, like, you know, I don't think it matters really the style. If a song is good, it's a good song, you know. I mean, of course, listen, if it's going to suit your voice as well, that's very important too. My husband is a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and my husband's opinion of what I do is very important to me, because, you know, it's not everybody that is a musical expert, and it's not everybody that is, you know, a trained opera singer. And you know, the majority of people that you will perform to aren't experts. So yeah, I think it's part of me. And I think this particular song that I'm choosing to sing in this concert, it's a great song. If I Fall Behind, Wait for Me. I mean,
are you addressing your husband directly there?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. And actually, I recently lost my dog, Sean. I had to put my little dog to sleep very recently. So, yeah, a little bit of emotional as well. And I think music is certainly therapy. It really is. It's certainly throughout the pandemic, it was therapy for so many people. It brings joy. It brings excitement. It lets you, you know, it does make you cry if you hear something and you're feeling in any way sad. But that is therapy, and it's cathartic, and it's so important. So
you'll be singing. You'll definitely be singing that Bruce Springsteen song then, If I Should Fall Behind, Wait for Me. And I see too that you have a Billy. Is it Billy Joel or Billy Joel in your house?
I think the Irish people call it Billy Joel, but I it's Billy Joel in our household.
And you're singing a lullaby. This has to be, I presume the lullaby is for the children.
Of course it is. Yeah, of course it is. You know, I do look on Billy Joel as a modern day Mozart. I really do. His volume of amazing, fantastic songs is so impressive, and his melodies. And you know, he's such a proficient pianist as well, and singer. I mean, he does it all. And Lullaby, yeah, certainly. When I had Blossom and George, my two children, I think this just captures just extreme love. And there's nothing like when you have a young child and I'm putting them to sleep, and, you know, just wondering where they're going off to, and their little minds, and wanting to protect them. And this is just such a caring, intimate song. I'm very taken with it.
Do you sing it to them at home to put them to sleep?
Yeah, like I listen, they're very used to me singing. Now Blossom is four, so she doesn't let me sing sometimes. She's probably one of the few people that says, "Stop singing, Mama." But I'm in the middle of teaching her PAYEZU because I really want to sing that duet with her.
Yeah, you're going to sing Summertime in there as well. I'm sure there'll be lots of operatic flavours, lots happening that'll be part of an absolutely brilliant concert. I want to finish up with Danny Boyle. A bit like Summertime, will people be singing along with this and wrecking the vibe on you, or do you mind that?
I don't mind that at all. I always welcome people singing along, and a song that I sing brings some, you know, happiness, and if people want to sing, absolutely. I have a different impression of Danny Boyle. I know it is seen as a kind of a camellia tune, or can be. For me, I've always just viewed it as a very intimate love song, and, you know, one of the greatest love songs. And if you only have to look at the lyrics, you know, for that, for if you come and all the flowers are dying, and I am dead, as dead I will may be, you'll come and find the place where I am lying. And, you know, it's just such intimate words. And it's not only the theme of emigration, which Ireland is steeped in that theme, but it's that love transcends everything. It transcends space, but it also transcends death.
Yeah.
And that's so important.
Yeah, great anti-war song, of course it is as well. There's no doubt about that. Claudia, listen, great to speak with you this evening. go off now back and finish off the rehearsals, and no sitting down at the next ones. It'll be standing up from now on, won't it?
It'll be all standing for me, yeah. But I'm very much looking forward to the concert. It's going to be a fantastic program, and I'm accompanied by just the finest musicians as well. So, and there will be something for everybody, accessible, great music.
Great. Lovely, Claudia. Thanks for that. And we'll finish up by listening to that recording of Danny Boy from your own website with David Quigley accompanying on piano. Voice there of Claudia Boyle with Danny Boy, David Quigley accompanying on piano. The 45th Kildare Derby Festival is where she will be performing Wednesday, June the 28th, kildarederbyfestival.ie for full details. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Leah Murphy researched. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night. We're in Cork for the Midsummer Festival. Lots to share with you from Cork tomorrow, so do join us at 7 o'clock. Apologies to John Creedon, we're a little bit over. He'll be with you after the news.